galactic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, though you're only linked to the past, maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Shivering alone in the dark in his subterranean refuge while nuclear fire ravages the world above this week is Jonathan Curley. An actor for stage, screen and audio, he's best known to Doctor Who fans as the voice of the War Doctor for Big Finish. Starring in the box sets Forged in Fire, Warbringer, Battlegrounds, He Who Fights with Monsters and Comrades in Arms. With more Big Finish work yet to come, he's also starred recently in the short film I Made War of the Worlds. Jonathan, hello.
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 That was a quite neat little audio CV you've just read off for me there.
Did I miss out anything vital or get anything wrong?
No, you pretty much summed me up in a nutshell or case, as the situation may be.
Yeah, that was my one job, so that's good. But this I Made War of the Worlds, I thought we'd kick off with instead of going straight to your childhood as we so often do when we're talking about Doctor Who. But so tell us about I Made War of the Worlds before we get into Doctor Who.
This is a smashing little short film that I worked on earlier this year with a brilliant chap called Luke Walters, who is also a fan, and written by Jamie Carroll, who is also a fan. And we met at an event in January and just got talking. And it's, you know, one of the peculiar things about how, you know, there are fans, but there are also fans who are inspired to get into the business. And sometimes it does come around full circle and you forge these little connections. And, you know, we got chatting about this idea that they had for a film. And basically we went out and did it. And the premise is, it's about a character called Jeff. If you're a War of the Worlds fan, you know, you don't need to do too many leaps to work out what that's in reference to, who is a podcaster, a slightly conspiracy theory-esque podcaster, who is basically sacked. And he decides to reboot his career by recreating the Orson Welles broadcast from the 1930s, 40s.
30s.
Yeah. When they basically caused this mass panic in thinking that that America was being invaded by aliens. So he uses all the tools at his disposal through social media and everything to try and repeat history, but it doesn't all go to plan. But yeah, it was a really fun thing to do. We shot it all in 3 days, and everyone on it is, we've all become really good friends. And it's won, I think at the moment, it's won 14 awards on the festival circuit. So we're all really proud of it. And let me put, without giving away too much, the story's not going to end there. There is more to come.
Oh, wow. Is that in terms of it kickstarting a bigger thing or?
Potentially, yeah. We're having chats.
So, oh, wow. Because it's a really good premise. I mean, there was that, God, was it a Spielberg film? The one that was set on the night. Of the Wells, it's sort of set in 1938 on the night of the Wells thing, when people apparently did think there was really a Martian invasion.
I think the Spielberg one was just another adaptation of the.
Oh no, yeah, there was a Spielberg adaptation, but for some reason it's like an old War of the Worlds. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find this. This is definitely an edit point for.
So Google,
The Night That Panicked America, made for TV drama. I just remember watching it on TV. It really stuck with me.
Yeah, because it's a great premise to do, you know, directly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not surprising that someone's tried to cover that, and you know, that well, it's that infamous hysteria, you know, from the time.
Yeah,
has there really been anything like it since?
No.
Could you do that again? I don't know. Well, that's what we explored with this film.
Yeah. No, it's a. I mean, obviously, War of the Worlds is at the center of the very show that we're here to discuss with the
indeed.
Well, War of the Worlds and obviously the Time Machine, but that science fiction that H.G. Wells is such a huge part of. But yeah, it's weird because I teach a lot of drama and writing and things, but one thing I keep getting brought in for is now audio drama. And so I was playing the Orson Welles that you can get on YouTube, the actual recording of that night. And what's weird is when you listen to it from the beginning, you would not be fooled because it talks about it being set a little bit in the future. And it's kind of it's a brilliant thing, brilliant sort of historical document, because obviously it was made in 1938 when people were worried that there might be war in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
He describes it's in the 40s and the fear of war has receded.
Yeah, this war allegory or almost Cold War allegory, really.
Yeah, yeah. But when he was making it, it was 1938. So the war against in Germany had the fear of it had receded in this near future that he was setting War of the Worlds in. So if you hear that bit, you wouldn't sit there thinking this was real. But but if you miss the beginning, when it's just the show being interrupted with a big band, you know, a big band playing and then news reports come in.
Funny enough, when for my A level, I did actually do. I did actually try and do a modern version of that. Like, what would it, you know, sound like in modern context? And in the research for that, I seem to remember there was a detail like the beginning might have been. A lot of people did miss the beginning because possibly of a transmitter failure,
yeah,
or there's a power cut locally,
that might have been it.
which removes some of the context.
Yeah, I saw a version of it live, and it must have been maybe it was a certain anniversary of it, but it was maybe over 10 years ago. But it had Mark Benton in it with a Doctor Who connection. He was playing the sort of main guy in it. The sort of narrator who everything happens to. But it was in Middlesbrough. We were watching it, and it was set in Middlesbrough. It was part of a big writing festival. And so they'd sort of set, instead of it, because Orson Welles, H.G. Wells famously sort of destroys places he loathes that he knows well, like Northolt and places, doesn't he? But in this, they'd just moved it all from London to Middlesbrough and surrounding areas. So it's just kind of surreal, but it was a brilliant live performance, you know, with Foley artists and all sorts of stuff.
Well, it's funny how well it does.
Mark Benson bounding around the stage. He's a brilliant actor.
It's funny how well it does lend itself to these different adaptations. Like, you've got a musical version, you've got the film that they made in the 50s that was contemporary, you've got the Spielberg one, which was you know, in the late noughties, which was set in a time, and only recently the BBC one was the first time it's been adapted, you know, to the period.
And
to,
I know,
why
and
has no one
weird,
ever done this before?
Well, that was always my little... You know, when you dream of being a writer and you go, well, one day, maybe if I ever make War of the Worlds, I'm going to set it actually in the time it was written, and it will be War of the Worlds, but it's going to be against the British Empire on a huge scale, like Independence Day against the British Empire. But then this version, the BBC version, wasn't quite that. It was more, for the most part, it was quite faithful to the book, set in that time. And then I don't think I watched the last episode because it didn't actually do it for me.
Yeah, the last episode did go in a slight tangent for me.
Yeah,
and again, funny thing, I did work on the BBC one.
Oh,
because I work as a supporting artist as well. So
yeah,
in layman's terms, a TV extra, and I did do a week on the bit where it was a sphere in this version, but basically the capsule.
Yeah.
Crash landing site. I was one of the people watching that, and it was proper sort of BBC classic visual effects situation because they had this great big black ball, and to make it vibrate, they had people running around on the inside and this sort of outer crust was stuck in with kebab skewers to fall away on cue. And I was like, I'm home. And wow, the slime that came off was just treacle.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Who needs CGI? And also, I remember the special effects. I remember liking lots of things about it. The special effects, especially. I think I remember it looking great and the cast being great. I think it just did something weird with the actual story that it's been a while since I've watched it. So, but you know, amazing. And I will have seen you on telly then.
Very briefly, blinking and you'll miss it.
But away from H.G. Wells and making War of the Worlds then, you actually did make War of the Worlds as an extra, and then you were in I Make War of the Worlds. So
my career's definitely taken a certain trajectory.
Yes. Well, I would say, unsurprisingly, as a Doctor Who fan, maybe you're slightly drawn to science fiction.
Maybe, one way or the other.
Could it be? So we're here because of Doctor Who, and I guess it's the inevitable question that I always ask, and the only way I can make it slightly different is by asking it later. But basically, Doctor Who, when did it come to you? When did it infest your life and take over?
Yeah, well, that's the thing about Doctor Who. It does find people. And I found it, or it found me, in the wilderness years. So before it came back in 2005.
Yeah, because you're I think quite it was, young, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm, hold on, 32. And I think I must have been 13.
Yeah.
So this was about 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And it was summer holidays, and my mum just put on the telly, there's a film on, I think you might like it. And it was Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD with Peter Cushing.
Oh, brilliant.
And this was, around 2000, you know, BBC was doing the reruns of Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet and all those Gerry Anderson shows. And I'd got into those big time. So the film isn't too big of a diversion because it's very much of a similar style of these, like with Daleks, they're almost like toys come to life, aren't they? So I was just kind of hooked.
Yeah, but it is
from that moment.
It is one of your choices, so I guess we'll make it the first choice then.
Yeah, nice segue.
It's always difficult when people give me their choices to go, well, which one's the one from their childhood and which one's one they discovered later? But Daleks Invasion of Earth, 2150 AD, obviously, you're not the first person to pick this because it is, especially to people who are, you know, the British people who didn't get a million repeats like the Yanks and the Australians and the Kiwis. We didn't get a lot of Doctor Who when it wasn't on. And so Daleks Invasion Earth being on, it was hardly ever the first one. It was always this one, it seemed.
I don't know what it is about it.
Permanent, almost as often as a Bond movie in my childhood.
I don't know whether that's because there was more of it shot outside or it just, you know, to a casual viewer, whoever's making the selections on what to put on a weekday afternoon, whether that's the one that's like, that looks right. And that's probably a big part of the appeal. It just looks and feels right for what it is.
Just the look of it's amazing, isn't it? The Dalek, I sometimes think the Daleks have hardly ever looked better than in that movie.
I'd agree. To be honest,
even the modern ones, as great as they look, there's just something even more iconic about the 60s ones, but in technical, when they look like TV-21 come to life.
There's a timeless simplicity to those 60s models with the silver and blue. And to just put them in sort of the earthy tones of you know, a destroyed London, they just really pop against that without, like, look incongruous, but at the same time, look on that, you know, that filmic effect. They just look right and real and proper and there and physical. It's not really something you can...
There's something about invasion as well. I mean, we've literally gone from War of the Worlds, which is a lot of it is London invaded, isn't it? And now we've got the Daleks doing the same, obviously inspired by that. Sort of inspired by the Blitz, the real life sort of the Blitz in the original version.
Yeah, because it's not really a war film. The battle's been and gone.
Resistance film, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, they've already won, so it's about their sort of their undoing and their downfall. I suppose, which is really, really works. Because rather than, you know, in the first film, you know, Doctor Who and his family, they are sort of the invaders that upset the status quo. The status quo in Invasion Earth is it's our world, and they've come in and disrupted everything. And how do you reset that against this thing, that these creatures, that there's nothing relatable about them at all, be it physically or with their ideology or even the way they speak. They use our words, but in a way that we've never heard them before. It's quite powerful stuff in its own way.
I mean, they are a crazy invention, the Daleks. I mean, you don't get so much of this just in this one movie, but just in the fact, I mean, obviously they're a Nazi allegory first and foremost, but they're also, when you take them in the whole, they're also born of a fear of World War III. So experience of World War II and then World War III. So it's very much Terry Nation's always forever sort of exploring what it is to resist fascism, basically.
And to survive
in everything,
fascism,
whether it's Blake Seven or Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So many times it's the resistance, and the resistance
it's very much a reaction to having lived through that recent history.
But they're not as bad as the Daleks. But they're a brilliant, absolutely. I mean, obviously it goes without saying with Doctor Who fans, but they are just such an amazing creation. Just such an amazing creation. And that film in particular is so, it gives me such a warm glow, because that was, I mean, sometimes I do look back and go, maybe it's spoiled TV Doctor Who. Because when I was, you know, I'm a lot older than you. So when we'd get to watch that version and then we'd watch clunky real Doctor Who when it came on, sometimes it was like, well, the special effects aren't as good as they were in 1966 or whenever it was made. because it was a big movie. But and Peter Cushing is just, I mean, I wish there'd been more of them. I wish they'd gone beyond.
If they'd had that third crack, what would we have gotten?
Well, there's a very different. Yeah. Well, when I think it was Matthew Sweet who broke the news in the Telegraph after the big the new print was showing at cinemas, and they had a BFI event, and so I think it was the son of the screenwriter Gordon Fleming. I think it's Jason Fleming. He then revealed that the third one was a sort of macro terror type affair that was maybe going to come out. So, because I remember...
because they found a script, didn't they?
Yeah, I remember Matthew...
A very rough
Matthew,
script.
Matthew Sweet got... Andy Mark Thompson of Whoville fame got commissioned to do the poster that never was for the third sort of Cushing Doctor Who. But I just think, oh, God, it would have just been great. Like, you know, if they'd had Ice Warriors, done 60s, you know, done Technicolor and all
It'd
of them.
It'd been quite a sort of left turn for it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I
don't think the chase would have worked on screen.
Maybe not.
I mean, we'd all love to see the battle with the mechanoids, but I don't think the chase, the story, would have landed. Master plan, maybe, but I don't think the chase would have worked.
But they might have. They might have sort of making it fit into 2 hours. They might have made it really. They might have sorted out some things. I mean, they sorted out some of the problems. You kind of forget, because this version has sort of taken over our brains. You forget until you actually watch the original Dalek Invasion of Earth, that we don't really do the end of the Dalek Invasion of Earth isn't very satisfying at all.
Because there's several cop-outs. And yeah, similarly in the first Dalek story as well. Like, they have this in the first Dalek story, they have this plan to blow up a neutron bomb. They find out it'll take too long, so they vent the reactor, which does the same thing anyway. What's the point in having that conversation?
And in
Invasion of Earth, they go through several processes that just achieve the same goal. The end of the film is a lot more sort of narratively and visually and dramatically satisfying overall.
I think it's just like that
second draft, just tighten it all up and not have to work around having to fill six episodes.
I don't think Terry Nation
past availability
did very many
and
second drafts. certainly the impression I get. So it's like, I'll do a second draft if I'm making a film of it, I suppose.
The only thing I think the film doesn't do quite as well as the TV show is that even though it's a film, there's no filming in actual London. It's all done on the back lot at Shepperton, isn't it?
I suppose, yeah, because they kind of merge in your head. The publicity shots that were in colour of the Daleks on Tower Bridge and all that, not on Tower Bridge, on Westminster Bridge and everything. Mm. With the Houses of Parliament in the background, in my head they kind of merge, but they were actually from the TV show, weren't they?
Yeah, so you don't have that quite the same iconography. If we had, it would be probably would have been stunning seeing that in widescreen in Technicolor.
Oh yeah,
with those props on Westminster Bridge.
Yeah,
it's just so strange that that's the one absent from the film that probably more people remember.
Yeah,
oddly enough.
Another thing I love about the movie Daleks is the guns and weird fire extinguisher that's deadly for some reason. But as a kid, they just work so well. There's no like shoddy lasers or anything. There's literally, if the gas gets you, you're dead, and it just looks brilliant when they're. They never really explain what it is or anything, but they never say it's a death ray. They just go.
Yeah, you just see the same consistent effect every time.
They just spray that stuff on it, and it's very visual when there's several Daleks at once getting someone. It just looks so effective. And especially to a child's mind, it's like, you know what you're seeing. You're seeing something physical hitting somebody and they're dying. It's brilliant.
Yeah, you just buy it. And it's not graphic, it's not gratuitous, but you get the idea.
Yeah,
which, is, you know, it's a sensible compromise because weren't they supposed to have flamethrowers in the first film, which would have been
that would be slightly different. Yeah, I was about to say one other thing. Doctor Who always does very successfully is find really non-gory ways to be violent and gets away with so much. It's like, well, we can see Cybermen impaled in the Five Doctors in horrible ways, but never people.
And that's the clever thing about it, because it leaves it to your imagination. And
even
though nothing is specifically shown, when you go to bed at night and your brain unpacks all that that's when it all comes out.
I'd say the only bit that has I mean, it looks brilliant, and obviously this is all part of it now, but the soundtrack is great in its own way, but it's kind of ludicrous.
Yeah, it is totally incongruous. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Because it's the 60s. Let's go.
Yeah, it's got this weird funky vibe when they're trying to start this insurrection.
Yeah, yeah.
This is so inappropriate. But it's so of the time.
Yeah, yeah. Daleks getting chucked down shafts and everything, and it's like the jazz is going crazy.
Yeah!
It's the sound of revolution in the 60s was jazz.
Choices were made. They were definitely made.
Out now from Cutaway Comics, part 2 of the Gods and Monsters saga.
And so I am banished.
Sutek.
Robbed of physical form, set adrift in the black void between galaxies. Not for the first time, for I am Sutek, destroyer, sworn enemy of all creation, and creation has many defenders, but this defeat feels different. Something new gnaws at what remains of my diminished soul. Not merely defeat, but something I dare not even name.
Sutek. Sutek. Sutek, hear me.
Next, this.
Yes, O brother husband. Let my voice guide you. Back to me, and home, to Neticatet.
The land of the dead, and yet, for me, it means life, a reprieve. And for the first time in millennia, a body!
In this place, you will always have form, or the appearance of form. But this you know, I have been granted permission to save you, but not restore you.
You always were weak, sister wife. Sentimental. The others would have let me die.
And they would have been justified in doing so. You were brought into this universe to bring chaos and suffering and death, but as part of the greater whole, you played a role in the balance of all things. And then, brother, husband, you forgot your place.
I declared war on all life.
You went insane. Even I, my love, wish death upon you. Only now...
You need my insanity.
Yes.
Who do you want me to kill?
An animated version of this trailer, starring Gabriel Wolf as Sutek and Zoe Iqbal as Nephthys, is one of the features on the VAM disc that comes free with the comic, only when you purchase direct from us at cutawaycomics.co.uk. So, gosh, 32, you are nearly 20 years younger than me. So, recalibrating. So, Dalek's Invasion of Earth in about the year 2000, you reckon?
Yeah, about then.
Yeah, and... then did you start the archaeology of So Many Wilderness Children Do?
Which is easier said than done, because I didn't have UK gold, so that sanctuary was not open to me. So it was going through trying to pick up the videos as and when, and you know, bear in mind a lot of them, the video range was coming to an end, I think, by that point. And a lot of them, of the early releases, had gone out of print, so they were quite, you know, quite pricey on the secondary market. So it was just whatever you could get. So again, like So Many Wilderness Children, my first TV story was Death to the Daleks.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the biggest selling ones did.
Your second choice. Yeah. Lots of people cite this as the first Doctor Who they ever saw, which is why I thought maybe it would be your first choice. But yeah, it's quite often people of a certain age, your kind of generation.
Yeah.
This VHS was their first sight of proper Doctor Who. So yes. How many times do you think you've watched that? Do you still have your VHS?
I do. I have all my videos. They're up in the loft now, because they're big chunky bricks and spaces at a premium.
You can't even take them to the charity shop anymore.
No, they won't take them. But yeah, I got that video one Christmas, and because it was the only sort of legitimate canon Doctor Who I had, it was basically just running on a loop. and I know in sort of objective terms, it's not regarded as particularly a remarkable story, never mind one praiseworthy one. But I find, you know, everyone remembers their first, don't they? And it's, for me, it's a comfort watch. And I think it's actually pretty solid, because you've got John Pertwee, who's five years into the role. And even though I think he decided to go at that point, he's still committed to delivering the character and delivering the performance. He's not phoning it in at all.
Well, he never stopped being committed to being the Doctor. You get the impression he never left home in anything other than his Doctor Who costume.
He always
rocked up to conventions as the Doctor. He was never. I'm going to be
fair play for that commitment.
And
even working with the Daleks, which he's on record as saying he hated them.
He
got probably, aside from Hartnell, probably the most stories out of anyone with them.
I also think his era of Dalek stories are kind of interesting, because I think they'd kind of run a bit out of road with the Daleks. And so I'm making this thesis up on the fly, but they were kind of good, solid adventure stories, but they did a little bit something different.
And they add a little bit of spice to a story that perhaps just needed it. Like Day of the Daleks, I think it's had a bit of a reappraisal recently, because it's the first one that really plays with the paradoxical time travel nature of things. And then, you know, at the last minute, they threw the Daleks in and it becomes something else. Then you've got Planet and Frontier, which is this massive space opera. Planet is kind of a retread of the first story, but a little bit snappier in colour. It's an episode shorter. And then you've got Death, where they basically, okay, we've got the Daleks. Let's take all their powers away.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is really interesting, because, you know, the violence the Daleks use is it's fantasy violence. They've got ray guns, pew, 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 and you turn inside out and negative. Then they give them machine guns. And that suddenly becomes so much more visceral and real. Now, the fantasy layer is kind of lifted, because they blow up the little TARDIS model, which is crazy. I love it. And then they go out and then they just mow down a bunch of Exelons because, yeah, we're just going to try this out. Brrr, down they go. Yeah, these are pretty good. Yeah, let's go to town. Yeah. And it's just mad. Mad, yeah. But yeah, that's what I think sets it apart for me.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. Yeah, I mean, I think of the novelization with that most amazing cover. Because of my age, the Target books were so important. They were like, you know, so Death to the Daleks was one I read over and over again. And I've, you know, but when I watch it, I still, you know, it's still a cracking little adventure story for me.
Yeah.
I think people get a bit sniffy about Terry Nation. They may be taken for granted, but he did know how to do a solid space adventure.
Yeah.
Know, sort of 1950s style. People on a mission, stranded. It never fails to work. Is it a jungle or a desert this time?
And it's great. His world building.
When are the Daleks
going
to arrive? And
his world building's brilliant. And some of the concepts he peppers through, like this idea of the city that is alive and has like cannibalized the people. The very people that built it. That's a feature film idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's blown it 4 weeks in on a Saturday in Saturday nights in 1974.
Yeah.
Because those root things I thought were brilliant. You know, the cliffhanger to, is it episode two? When it just rises up off the floor and shrieks and John Pertwee doesn't have a clue what to do with this thing. and the only other thing that I want to say is you got Sarah Jane as well, who is only three. This is a third story, but her character is so well established. Elizabeth Sladen is just flying by this point. But you contrast the characterization here versus what we get later on. Mm. You really feel that there's a journey here with that character. She's not the same in the same place as she is 3 years on. She really does. She really does grow both in herself and with the Doctor, who of course changes partway through. And then we get Bilal as well, who could have been a companion, the companion who never was.
Yeah.
But, there's so many suiting up Arnold the Arrow and rubber for for 6 months of the year might have been asking a bit too much, but what a lovely characterization.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at cutawayuniverse.
So, with your VHS and your various other stories, how did you feel when Doctor Who was announced 20 years ago, when Doctor Who was... the news came, it was coming back.
Well, it was the timing of it couldn't have been better, really, because I actually knew what it meant. I remember hearing it on the radio going on the way into school one day, that it was announced that it was coming back. And I thought, oh, I know what that is. Whereas, you know, all the other people didn't really mean anything to them. I think the name Doctor Who was somewhat familiar, and, you know, and the name of the Dalek, a Dalek, is, you know, it's just part of our culture now.
Mm-hmm.
But what this show actually was and consisted of, you know, actually resonated with me. And then when it came back, you know, I'll be perfectly honest here. I don't think I've admitted this anywhere else, that initially I didn't think it was right. I didn't accept it as, you know, true Doctor Who that I'd been expecting, because it was so new and modern and relevant. But by the end of the series, I've been one round. But it was just lovely to get Doctor Who offered to you every week, not having to hunt for it in the same way. Doctor Who provides, Russell provides.
I mean, it just seemed like a weird miracle that it had come back and wasn't bad. I was like watching it. I mean, don't be shit, as I was saying in one of my, to Emma Reeves just yesterday, that please don't be shit. Oh, you're not shit. That's good. Well, you're okay then. Oh my God, you're actually really good. Oh my God, you've become huge. And everyone in the pub is talking.
And then it becomes everyone.
Not just the playground, in the pub. Everyone. Yeah. In the hairdressers. Everyone's watching it.
I think that's the thing about fans, is they get, because it's something that they've lost before, they get anxious about letting someone else play with their toys or have to share things about.
Yeah.
But it's okay. It's fine. It just means there's more fans, there's more people to keep this thing alive
in
the long term.
Yeah, I do think some fans, especially older ones, maybe it's an attitude thing, not an age thing, but I think they would rather it just stopped so that they could have it all.
And, yeah, it's complete.
And it would just slowly die, but they'd die, you know, but it would be fine because they'd still carry on having the bits that they always liked.
Yeah, we know all of what Doctor Who is, and it's ours, and we keep it, and no one can touch it. That's it. It's finite now.
Don't change it.
Yeah, we can control it. We know what it is.
Yes, it lasted for 26 years through constantly changing, but don't change it. Please don't change it. But I just love the fact it's come back, and we've had 18 years of it now. And I remember being at the Capitol this time round, and Matthew Waterhouse and Sarah Sutton were on stage, and they said, well, the show is now at the point where we came in, as in that's how old it is. So the sort of Shooty and Ruby Tuesday eras, that's Nyssa and Adric coming in. In terms
so
of
we're,
the
we're
show
entering
being...
the new JNT years.
Yeah,
RTD, well... JNT, ooh.
Yeah, I also, but I think there the analogy ends because that was a period of decline. I mean, much as it was great, but there's no arguing that the first four Doctors, that was a show that everyone watched of every age. Yeah. And then 5 to 7 was the show that Doctor Who fans watched.
Well, there's all of that we can learn from. And Russell will, of course, be learning from. And, you know, from his own era, he's done it before. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you think about this, but in the Tennant era, basically, the show was so huge, it could almost do no wrong. I don't think we'll see an exact repeat of that. I think it will get hugely popular, but not quite in the same way because we're not in 2007 anymore.
No, I mean, people just didn't time shift as much. You know, there was all this, count how many views there are on iPlayer, but people still mostly served up what they were got on the channels when it was on the channels, and the streamers weren't there. I mean, so much has changed. There's competition for it, but I mean, even when it wasn't doing it's always done quite well. But during Moffat's tenure, when it wasn't as huge as it had been, it was still being seen by 77 million people every episode globally. That was it.
Yeah, because that was like a period of transition. It was becoming big in America, which is where they were really pushing it because, you know, that's growth.
Yeah.
Morphing into this different beast.
Yeah, so if you say every globally with Disney on board, every episode might be seen by about, you know, in excess of 100 million people in its in its week of release, then then that's a show that's doing all right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who knows? But I just think the main thing is I think it's going to be big. And my main hope is, because I have an 8-year-old who's the only Doctor Who fan in his whole school, like teachers who are a bit young haven't heard of it. So that's really? That's how long Doctor Who's sort of been away from the public, from its core audience, which is children. And I'm just hoping, a bit like you were ready for Doctor Who to come back, that he is 8, a Doctor Who fan, and suddenly he is the person who knows all about this cool show that they're all just rediscovering or discovering. That's what I'm hoping, that it becomes a family show again.
Yeah.
Like more than it has been.
Yeah.
You know, a family show that's popular and we can't move for it. And
yeah, something that unites everyone together across the generations.
Yeah, but we shall see. But either way, the main thing is it's going to be brilliant. I'm fairly sure it's going to be brilliant. So your Doctor Who came back and it was good. And
it was.
In a way, you were a bit old to be fully appreciate Doctor Who. That there's that first flush of discovering Doctor Who when you're 5 or 6 and then 8, 9, 10 is like the all, you know, so you became a teenager while it was on. But I guess you're a teenager, but it was fairly cool compared to other times in its history.
Yeah, it definitely sort of reached its sort of maturity, didn't it? Because like I was old enough to appreciate it, but not young enough to be sort of affected by it at that visceral level. I didn't have the hide behind the sofa experience.
Yeah, I was going to say,
but by that point,
have you ever been young and scared by Doctor Who?
Oh, I mean, some of the ideas.
Death of the Daleks, or
no, I wouldn't call Death of the Daleks terrifying by any stretch. But there are definitely things that make me think, for sure. Like I remember in Silence in the Library, Forest of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
There's all that exploration of dreams.
Yeah,
I became so self-aware of that that I don't think I could sleep for a couple of nights afterwards.
Yeah,
it's the weird way it gets under your skin in that way. You know, and there's a certain concept like the Cybermen.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of, I think the concept of the Cybermen is slightly more terrifying than the Daleks to me,
mm-hmm.
because it's slightly more real. And you know, one thing that we've seen in a few stories now is what if it happened. Mm-hmm. But it was botched. What if it was done on the cheap?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you get converted into a Cyberman, it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing is a little bit horrifying.
Yeah, I loved what Moffat did with the season 10 Cybermen. Mm. I think they're the best they've been since probably
since the Troughton era. Or
I was about to say the Troughton era, yeah. Because that, you will be like us.
Mm.
Kind of era when they were chilling and a bit silly, and then they became that body horror of they are, and they, it was just brilliant. It was just genius.
Yeah, probably got just back to their roots, but not in like a fan servicey way. This was about what the Cybermen are
at
a conceptual level, which is an idea.
Yeah, that whole two part
development gone wrong.
Yeah, that whole two part is some of the best new Who, but it's not on your list, so we mustn't get.
It got close though.
It got close. Yeah. No, it's a brilliant one. It's brilliant. I mean, obviously, there's so much to choose from. But the reason I've mentioned the 50th a few times is because you have chosen Night of the Doctor. What was the 50th like for you?
50th was, well, it was like the hype, because there was so much hype around it. And by this point, I was a quote-unquote grown responsible adult. You know, I was out in the real world with a proper job. God, someone actually thought I was capable of doing that. So, but I was still following the show, of course. And you know, I remember this process and the anticipation. And I was at the celebration that they did in London when, you know, the massive convention. And of course, they screened Day of the Doctor.
At the Excel place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was like going to Lourdes, you know, this massive worshipping place. We'd all been on a pilgrimage because it was huge. It never felt bigger, really, which I think was possibly why the show may, in some people's perception, plateaued afterwards. Because once you hit 50 and you have that scale, where do you go from there? Because we've been aiming for it for so long, and people probably expected me to put Day of the Doctor into the vault, but no, I've been obtuse, as with many of my choices, and chosen Night of the Doctor, which introduced the War Doctor, but mainly features the Eighth Doctor, Paul McGann. And this is another choice based on my experience of seeing it, because I mean, for most of us, I think it came pretty much out of the blue.
Yeah.
Because we knew, I think we might have known there was some kind of prequel episode.
I deliberately disengaged from, God love Doctor Who fans, but there were too many of them that seemed to think spoilers, you know, knowing everything that happens in advance is part of being a Doctor Who fan. I'm the opposite. I absolutely hate knowing what's going to happen next. I even tried when the new Doctor was announced, when it was Jodie Whittaker, I even tried seeing if I could not find out.
Yeah.
And it was impossible. But
imagine if they could do a stealth regeneration today.
Yeah, just to not
if we
know.
We could all share that experience of not knowing.
But when Jodie turned back into David, I'd kind of heard of that, but I also wasn't sure if it was just a silly rumour. So
it almost seemed too out there to be true.
I deliberately disengaged from, and I especially did for the 50th because I didn't want to know anything. And as a result, I didn't know about the McGann thing at all. Somebody just said, oh, there's a really cool minisode, because there were quite a few minisodes, weren't there? And they weren't.
Yeah, I think there was a couple.
They were all fine, but they weren't as earth-shattering as Night of the Doctor. But then I didn't know that Tom was coming back. So I absolutely got gut-punched and was blubbing mess in the cinema.
And that was blown by Tom himself on the day.
I know, but I managed.
He got so close.
So many people have said, oh, I was spoiled by Tom Baker or by a fan, assuming everyone had heard.
Ironically, given I was there, I had no idea. So I managed to escape. I managed to dodge that one.
Oh, thankfully. Yeah. Yeah, and I was in a cinema full of Doctor Who fans, and somehow I managed to not overhear somebody spoiling it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, brilliant. And I mean, that was a brilliant day. But Night of the Doctor. So, I mean, obviously, for you personally, as a war doctor yourself, it's taken on a significance that you wouldn't have been able to probably dream of when it was.
It has, really. Because, I mean, all there is in that is they comp in a little sort of blurry image of a young John Hurt.
Is it him from Caligula? Because, you know, from I, Claudia.
No, it's from Crime and Punishment.
Oh, is it? I see, yeah.
It's one of the two publicity photos that the BBC own, which is why they're able to use it. And they've used them on my box set covers.
Oh, I see.
But if they just put Sir John as he was then, as he would appear in Day of the Doctor, I wouldn't have a job.
Yeah. So it's just it would be a bit odd as well to go and... Yeah, he's gonna regenerate into an old man because he just asked to be a warrior. So maybe they're going, oh, is this a warrior?
Yeah,
is this your idea of a warrior?
Yeah, so immediately invited that gap, and we all love gaps to fill with our headcanon or Big Finish definitely love their gaps. So yeah, that was a conscious choice, I think, to invite that a sense of history. For that, there was a whole lifetime or lifetimes for this incarnation. Their life wasn't just a length of an episode. There's a whole legacy there. But also, in the sense of the Eighth Doctor, Paul McGann, you know, it was his first reappearance since the TV movie. Mm. He'd done the audios and Big Finish, but this was a real sense of like coming home and validation for him. You know, that he was part of this time war situation and just really we'd seen the beginning, now we saw the end in a similar way. You know, we've got this whole it just says this is a complete life. It's not a loose end anymore. It's a complete life, a complete character. And Paul absolutely smashed it. He smashed it. And honestly, I think it's possibly the best 7 minutes Stephen Moffat's ever written.
It's certainly up there. It certainly does a million great things. And I tell you what, from a Big Finish point of view, it represents like on three prongs. A, it sort of half officially canonizes the because he mentions the companions when he's regenerating. So you know the argument is it makes them canon, but by BBC rules it doesn't because nothing can be canon if it's not if you can't access it via the license fee, but. Mm. But for all intents and purposes, it makes Big Finish as McGann. And it already worked like that for me because there's so much Big Finish. Obviously, you can't buy it all. But the one thing I've never missed an episode of is McGann because that's the Doctor, the Eighth.
That's him. That's his home.
And he is, as a result, he's vying with Tom Baker as my favourite Doctor.
Mm.
You know, like I...
Because he's had such a journey to really explore... that character without having to sort of sneak into the gaps and have to adhere to those defined beginning and end and midpoints.
Yeah.
It just really had the freedom to explore. And it was really influential on the show when it did come back and what the Doctor could be, post the TV show, post survival.
Yeah, there was a back and forth between Big Finish in general, but the McGann strand in particular. So before the show came back, it was very influential, I think, consciously or subconsciously, to what the show was when it came back. But then when the show came back, we got the Sheridan Smith era. So it kind of fed backwards and we got...
Yeah, I remember listening to those.
And they were really like, God, this is what, this is what it would be like if we had a series with McGann.
Yeah,
and it just
I mean, I don't know if it'll ever happen. By the time this goes out, it may already be happening.
You never know. Well,
but I've said this leaves us wanting more. Yeah, at the end of that minisode.
You're actually the third person in a row who's picked Night of the Doctor, and I don't know if that's
really.
but I don't know if it's because the 60th is in the air, so everyone's reminiscing.
Maybe,
but, But it's a brilliant, it's just, I mean, it was such a magical 7 minutes, as you said.
Going back to what I said about the experience of seeing it, it dropped in the middle of the day and I was at work. And on my lunch break, I watched it. And there was one of my co-workers was also a fan. And it was this thing that we, if we got in early, we'd spend ages just talking about, you know, Doctor Who and the episode that had just been on. He'd been out at a meeting or something in the day. He came back middle of the afternoon, furious. And he just looked at me and said, "Have you seen it?" And I was like, "Yes." So next thing you know, we go into the meeting room and put it on the big screen. And everyone else follows us because they'd heard, "What? Paul McGann's come back." And even though he'd only done the movie, everyone somehow was aware that Paul McGann was the Doctor and had accepted him as the Doctor and was just on board for this moment. And I'll never forget that, because it was just a combined experience that just transcended the little private lives that we fans have, where, you know, Doctor Who's for us. This is something we could share with everyone. So yeah, it was just lovely. And I think it had the intended effect.
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, but the fact that it gave Big Finish that legitimacy, which, I mean, they didn't really need anyway, because they kind of already had it. But then it gave them a gap. It basically gave them permission to have war, to have Eighth Doctor war, Time War, as much as you want. And also, very relevant to you, to have the War Doctor as well, being young. So, and which obviously fed into Day of the Doctor, which was very much, he'd been doing this for centuries.
Yeah, because we've got to remember, Day of the Doctor is the last day of the War Doctor's life.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the very end point. The last, so what happens leading up to that? And that's what, yeah, you know, I've had the privilege of being able to portray and explore.
It's amazing. It's amazing. But yeah, and I love Night of the Doctor. And the only slightly sad thing from it is it comes from the fact that the BBC wouldn't let Moffat have McGann in Day of the Doctor. So I've been told that he wasn't considered famous enough. So then,
yeah, I've heard so, rumors about that.
Yeah. And, so before that, it was, "Oh, Eccleston won't do it." Oh, actually, well, that's sad. But actually, what if I bring McGann back?
Yeah,
amazing.
And we'll then, always wonder what could have been.
Yeah, but then I think the War Doctor was such an amazing. Well, you wouldn't have played the War Doctor because you wouldn't.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm slightly biased, but
yeah, yeah.
But then I do think
the War Doctor was such an amazing invention. All these things come out of weird little back behind the scenes stuff, but all we really need to worry about is what did we get, and we got a brilliant surprise. That whole era, the build, you know, with the War Doctor being seeded in, and then Night of the Doctor, and then bang, here's the Doctor. The War Doctor amongst with 10 and 11 as well. Just absolutely brilliant.
Just very much a case of adapt and survive. Yeah, that we got John Hurt.
John Hurt, we got him as a Doctor. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Free on DVD with issue 6 of Warp Warp.
I stopped the car at last and let the fog close in around
me. Brand new animation by Mel.
I knew I was somewhere on Barnes Common, and I had a suspicious idea it was the most deserted part as well.
Adapted from the opening chapter of Doctor Who and the Daleks by David Whittaker.
I'm Barbara. Barbara Wright. Susan. Susan is in the road.
A meeting on the common.
Oh my goodness.
I say, you there. Are you trying to get us all killed? There's petrol everywhere!
Featuring Stephen Noonan.
What are you doing here?
As the First Doctor. Out now. Order online at warpwarp.co.uk. Bring us on to your Big Finish work. So is it right that it kind of came out of Doctors Assemble during lockdown?
Or, not quite. That was kind of the renaissance, I suppose. But I'd done bits and pieces here and there way back. And like I mentioned before, real life took over and I drifted sort of away from, you know, doing fan stuff, really. I dip my toe back in now and again because, you know, I am a voice actor. I love Doctor Who. Occasionally I'd chuck a voice out there and say, I've done this thing, you know, let someone else enjoy it. or tear it to shreds, whatever. I'm not precious. But I'd done a couple of tracks of the War Doctor because each Doctor comes along, I kind of see that as, right, the gauntlet has been thrown down. What can I do with this? So I'd done a couple of bits, not so much with Jodie because there are a couple of obstacles there. I'd put them out there. People were very kind about them. But back then they were very much sort of caricature, I'd say, because John Hurt has a great voice, an incredible voice. But then, yeah, about, when would it have been? 2019, I think. A chap I'd worked with before, Luke Oliver, I'd done an audio project with him playing the 12th Doctor. But he knew that I could do War Doctor as well. And he was doing this sort of spoken word poem called Ode to a Time Lord, where each Doctor would read a different verse. So he asked me to do 12 and the War Doctor. And I believe Kenny Smith picked up on it and said, and sent to someone at Big Finish, might have been Nick Briggs, I'm not sure, but said, have you heard this War Doctor voice? It's amazing. And from what I understand, he got a text back saying, we are aware, which is very ominous. So I must have been on some sort of radar back then. And and then out of the blue, I get an email from Nick Briggs saying, can we have a chat? Which again is equally ominous. Because I thought, well, this might not even be War Doctor. It might not even be Doctor Who, because Big Finish does so many different things. But no, it was that. And we came up with a plan to approach it or look at approaching it. And then 2020 happened, basically, which kind of left things a bit up in the air. So Emily Cook, who will probably be running the show one day when Russell has passed the baton over. And I mean that sincerely. She was doing a lockdown project and did Doctors Assemble and a few other voice actors and impressionists on board. And my name got into the mix and we put it out. And that kind of weirdly, coincidentally, even though that, you know, we were planning to do War Doctor Begins, kind of put me back on the radar and sort of warmed people up to what I was doing or what I could do. So when the announcement came, it wasn't such a Jonathan who, because, you know, some people had, you know, they had a read on the situation. It's like, oh no, actually this could be pretty good because it had gone down well before. And the rest is kind of history. We eventually got it up and running, recorded the first couple of sets remotely. Now we're in studio and just having a fantastic time.
Yeah, I'm glad they're going back to studio, because just from a personal point of view, because I just recorded my Big Finish and I was dreading that I'd be on the other end of a clean feed, because I did that during lockdown for something else. And I was like, I got to record Peter Davison recording my script, but where was I? Stuck in traffic and then in a service station. And Peter Davison in his cupboard. And
I feel for you.
And I'm like, but I finally got to meet him at the BFI, and we were like, you know, I said, oh yeah, we have worked together, but I was in a lay-by. In a service station. And
it's funny that.
I was in my bloody cupboard.
Because
yeah, 2 years.
Big Finish Day last year. that was the first time I'd met most of the people I've been working with.
Yes, man.
It was the first time we'd all got in the room. So it was quite a surreal experience. Like, yes, I know you. We've worked together. I just don't know what you look like.
Yeah, I mean, the whole pandemic was just obviously a global cataclysm, but just so surreal with all the lockdown and the way we adjusted to work. But one of the tiny weirdnesses of it, as Russell T. Davis has sort of acknowledged, is that Emily Cook's sort of tweet-alongs and rewatches kind of kickstarted the next phase of Doctor Who, with David and Donna coming back, you know, David and Catherine Tate coming back, which is just incredible. Just a little tweet.
That itself is so of its time, because I don't know, you know, with Twitter or X in the state it's in at the moment, whether that could have happened in the same way.
Yeah.
But it's lovely that we did have that moment together in spite of everything else.
But I mean, John Hurt, did you ever meet John Hurt?
I didn't. unfortunately.
I have been lucky enough to meet him. My big joke is, because I met him for V for Vendetta, and my big joke is, I met him and he was brilliant, and I could tell he was going to make it great one day. And he did when he became the Doctor. So
the pinnacle of his career.
Yes. But obviously, no, an amazing, amazing actor and a really, really nice guy.
I love hearing stories of people who have, you know, been fortunate enough to work with him, both at Big Finish and elsewhere, because it just helps give me a little insight into the man who is so close yet so far for me.
I know, it's very surreal, but I must say it is uncanny, your performance.
Oh, thank you.
It's brilliant. It's you and Tim Treloar and Steve Noonan. It's just like, whoa.
When people say that they don't realize it's me, you know, sometimes I think I have to put on the voice just to prove that it is me. Because there's such a disconnect. But I feel like if they don't realize it's me, I've done my job. It's not about me. It's about the character. It's about the story.
Yeah. I mean, it must be a strange thing to approach, because it's like you don't want it to be an impersonation. I mean, I've just been working with Steve Noonan on the thing for Vorp Vorp, which you might have seen, the Meeting on the Common animation that we're doing for the 60th. And so having a big discussion about impersonation versus performance and the sort of bit of both that you have to do.
Yeah, and Stephen's very meticulous about that.
And
because I massively respect.
Yeah, but with your performance, whatever you're doing is perfect, because you never go, you never have the uncanny valley bit of, oh, that's not the right voice. You just get swept along by the story.
Yeah,
so you're doing, you're obviously doing the acting bit well, and also whatever choices you've made with John Hurt.
Yeah, I'm getting away with it.
You're getting away with it. They never made me go, oh, that wasn't John Hurt.
Dreading the day that I come down with a cold before a recording session. Otherwise, that's gonna blow all the magic. Maybe it'll make me sound better, a bit more gravel and rasp.
What's it like on your... Because, I mean, as people can hear, you don't sound at all like John Hurt. So what's it...
Oh, it's getting there. As I get older, it's becoming a little closer to me, a little more.
What's it actually like with your instrument?
It's a lot easier than it was. When I had the initial conversation about it, Nick Briggs said, find a way that you can sustain it. Because, doing the Daleks all the time, he knows what it's like.
Mm.
So I had to put the work in to find a nice sort of mid-ground. But also, because he's going to be younger, I've got a little bit of leeway. So it was a bit tricky at first, sort of maintaining it and selling it for myself more than anything else. But now it's much more kind of like second nature. I can slip into it as I just did. because it's like Ken Bentley said that it's like with singers and opera singers especially, they find that muscle, that spot, and as it gets more exercised, it's a lot easier to slip into, and I think that's where I'm at now.
No, it's an amazing thing. So, have you got more to record? I mean, I imagine knowing a little from personal experience of how far in advance they bank these things. How many are banked and how many are coming? Or can't you say?
Yeah, not with me. No. You've caught me at a strange time, because War Doctor Begins is actually coming to an end. That's as much as I know and I can tell you. I've not been sacked, I've not upset anyone. But what happens next is that's up to the future to decide.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at cutawayuniverse.
So your next choice is also one of my favourite things from the Hooniverse, as we shall now call it, but I was calling it anyway, is Torchwood, Children of Earth.
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing. How many episodes was it? Five?
Five, yes. Over consecutive nights.
I know. It was brilliant. I've watched it quite a few times over the years.
Yeah. It's another thing that I think is one of the best things that Russell's ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Such a powerful story that's not only good for Torchwood, it's not only good for Doctor Who, it's just good television.
Yeah.
And because it was established, it was able to really play with that and push that, because you know, people were familiar with what the concept of Torchwood was, like almost a British X-Files, mm-hmm. and just really push this quite intense and mm-hmm. quite brutal story, because it dealt with children, and that's a very precious subject for a lot of people and a lot of viewers. And it was just so well done. Torchwood really reached its peak and potential with that. It's a shame that it never really got the opportunity to properly build on that again.
No.
But I'm so glad that we got what we got.
Yeah.
Because it properly found its groove in that moment. It was an event. And with it being consecutive nights, again, coming back to the idea of how you ingest something, this was more aimed at, you know, sort of the age I was. I would have been 17, going on 18.
2010. I'm seeing my flat I was in when I was watching it. I think it was like 2010. So
me and my friends all took turns going to each other's houses to watch it together, and we'd go to the pub after to debrief. So just watching again as a communal experience is something very special to me. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was, you know, for those five nights, it was gripping. It was that momentum just carried on, and we were hooked from beginning to end.
It was absolutely brilliant. Also, I mean, it was July 2009. Wikipedia has just told me. I was in that flat. But
The special years.
For those interested in which flat I was in. But also, I think one thing I always love is when things from Doctor Who or Doctor Who-related things aren't just watched by me and my mates that all like Doctor Who anyway. I love it when it transcends. And my parents watched it. Like they'd watched Russell's, you know, they'd watched Eccleston and Tennant, and then they'd tailed off almost immediately after Tennant left. Not for anything in particular, but just because I think it was probably just scheduled against something they'd rather watch.
Yeah,
something as simple as that. But also, it came to a natural stop with Tennant regenerating. But Children of Earth was something, for whatever reason, they went, oh, well, it's a bit like they'd watch, you know, A Silent Witness stripped over several days. They sat down and watched Children of Earth, and its tone, it's the way it looked. Everything was just perfect TV. And it really reminded me, weirdly, of like, I don't know, like Edge of Darkness and things like that from the 80s. Like really good, solid drama with a slight science fiction.
It'd be like a sort of Black Mirror thing that we get today, isn't
it? Yeah.
That kind of dark.
It was weird how much it was conceptual. Like a rival that came after it as well.
Yeah.
With the tetrapods in Arrival, but this was the things that were splurging all over the...
Yeah, the much less benevolent kind.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, well, it's really tricky for Doctor Who to have friendly aliens. Whenever you do, you're like, oh, there's no adventure, is there? Where's the adventure? Three aliens are friendly. But it's always a real trick to... you know, you have to be really clever to have friendly aliens. I just loved everything about it. I'm not like the world's biggest Torchwood fan. I'm kind of glad it exists. But I did have a problem with, maybe I'm a bit of a Puritan, but I think the Whoniverse should be accessible to everybody. You know, it should be 12 certificate at most.
Mm-hmm. There is no sex in the Whoniverse. It's completely celibate.
Not so much that, but you can have sex and you can have people getting, you know, kissing and things. Mm. And you could probably occasionally have a bastard or even the word fuck, like you can in 12. I felt a bit the same when Star Wars does it or when Marvel does it.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah. Pick a lane. Like,
yeah, I hear you. Yeah, you know, because the accessibility thing is important. It's that safe space where you don't have to deal with all that.
Deadpool on for his girls and got so much shit with his ex because he just thought it was a Marvel. It was a superhero movie.
Yeah,
and it was Deadpool, and he wasn't in the room and just heard them screaming, and it was like, oh, they've just been talking about teabagging and balls, and then there's a massive hardcore sex scene, and he's like, what the fuck?
Well, that was the thing about the first series of Torchwood, really, in that it was kind of had, in that almost adolescent sense, felt it had to prove itself in how mature and adult it was.
It seemed too childish to me because of that.
Like, yeah,
a bit try hard. I mean, I think I remember reading in the writer's room when Russell T's talking about it, and he said, oh, I wish I hadn't had that fuck in the right in the beginning of the first scene of Torchwood. I think Sarah Jane Adventures is absolutely perfect.
Oh yeah, right? Brilliant.
Because it knew what it was. It was so well formed, and you could access it if you were the target audience, and then if you were a Doctor Who fan, you could access it as well, because it was basically Doctor Who. Sometimes the tone was almost the same.
And it was sometimes just a darker show. It's just for kids.
Yeah.
You know, good writing is good writing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it worked, you know, for everyone. You know, I'm one of them. I enjoy it. I'm far too old for it, but I really enjoyed and appreciated that show and what it did at a time when, well, especially now, children's TV is kind of in a decline, if not in terms of the quality, but definitely the quantity.
Yeah,
and the resources it has to call upon. It's
in decline in terms of quantity, but also it has to be so safe now, or something has happened in our culture to make it so safe. And I think that was another great thing about Sarah Jane, was because it was science fiction, it got to be edgy and sad and deal with themes that...
Yeah, and challenge its audience.
They do. I mean, I'm doing lots of other shows wrong because, you know, you've got Tracy Beaker and things like that that do go there as well. But it was just absolutely perfect. But on the flip side, I think Torchwood was a sort of flawed thing that found its feet, because I don't think having an adult Doctor Who... I mean, lots of people absolutely love it, and I do like it. I just prefer it when it heads to this perfect version, which is Children of Earth for me, which is Certificate 12, edging towards 15. But you could sit down with your kids and watch it, because they'll be terrified. But it's still Doctor Who. It's still Doctor Who. And that's why, Children of Earth is brilliant. And then I thought the American version might have gone that way, but it sort of derailed a little bit as it went along, didn't it?
I may be totally wrong, but from watching it, I feel like it was a 5-episode idea, same format as Children of Earth, but basically were by order of a network said, double it, we want 10 episodes.
Yeah, 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 because I liked it as it was starting to go on, and then it was like, somebody spinning of wheels. Something's not quite right here.
Because the idea and concept behind it was sound.
Yeah.
It just didn't have enough steam to support itself, I don't think, which is a shame.
Yeah. But I wonder if we'll get more Torchwood, or is UNIT going to have Torchwood elements, or there's probably room for both. So we shall see. I just love the idea of Torchwood is brilliant. And again, this is where Big Finish kind of picks up the baton, because...
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, they kind of go... Well,
Russell himself has given his blessing to say it's official.
Yeah, all the development has been done. It's found its tone. and then Big Finish get to go, yay! Here's loads of Torchwood.
Knowing what Torchwood is, and knowing that audience, I think Big Finish has been very responsive to that and been able to really push those buttons of what works, and push those boundaries that you wouldn't get on a mainstream TV show. You can go more niche and direct and really affect the people that are, you know, literally buying into this thing. There's been some brilliant stuff put out in the Torchwood range, because you know, yes, it's made with love, and it's made by people who get it, and it's made for people who want it.
Yeah, and it's one of those it's one of those strands that I haven't listened to all that much of it as well. So it's every so often I dip into one and go, oh, that, I really like that. So, damn you, Big Finish, you're so expensive. I mean, not that expensive for what you get, but there's so much of it.
Oh, for a professional account.
Yes, yes. Well, I know people, those people who have those review accounts. It's damn you. But anyway, I've just on McGann episodes alone, I've probably spent a mortgage.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you.
Gods and Monsters, Issue 1, Fausti, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega, El Trala, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space.
Onto your last choice. Finally, the most left field pick I think we've ever had on this show is the Trial of Davros stage play. So I have not seen this, but Gareth, the head of Cutaway, did see it in 93, I think, and 2005.
Oh, wow.
So, because he's a massive Doctor Who fan, obviously, but also local to Manchester. Although I was about to say I wasn't around here in 1993, but I was at university. But I just didn't hear about it because I was
2 years old, so I don't know who's got the better excuse.
I was too busy being in the Hacienda and
fair enough.
And doing dancing.
Dancing.
And drinking water. So you saw it in 2005 in Ashton, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. The TV series had just come back and yeah, I know I'm being obtuse with my choices. You said any medium, and I took that and ran with it.
Yeah.
And the annoying thing about Trial of Davros is that it's not been adapted since. I know Big Finish did a series of the stage plays, mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, the Trial of Davros, possibly because it was a charity thing, mm-hmm. Was an exception. It was put on by the Hyde fundraisers.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember seeing just a flyer. He had a stack of flyers in Forbidden Planet in Manchester with Trial of Davros and a big picture of Terry Malloy's Davros. And I went to see it with my parents. And seeing a Doctor Who thing live on stage is weird because I've never done it before, never done it since. I'll tell you what, I've seen the when they did the Matt Smith one, Doctor Who Live.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, seeing Davros, Terry Malloy as Davros in full makeup in the chariot and everything.
Yeah.
Because this was relatively early on in my sort of Doctor Who experience. Because it's got John Leeson in it, obviously not playing K-9. He's just playing another character.
Yeah.
And it's got Nida in it as well, played by Peter Miles. And yeah. I'd not actually seen Genesis by this point. So it kind of went a little bit over my head, and only in hindsight have I sort of connected the dots and, oh, that's what, and I just wish I'd appreciated it more at the time.
It sounds like a very, I mean, it must have had an impression on you because it's one of your five. So
yeah, because it was so unique and just because I like to be awkward.
Yeah.
So
you're not, just to be clear, you're not allowed all the cast performing it whenever you want in the bunker. It's
no, unfortunately, it's going to be, I've just got my memories.
Yeah, it's going to be a camcorder from the time filming it.
So when the PTSD kicks in and my memories get merged.
Yeah. shaky camcorder recording of it.
Yeah, as I'm sure, action figures, trying to play it all out.
Yeah.
Well, you can't even get like a script or a plot synopsis of it, but I'll try and basically briefly sum it up now.
Yeah.
In the original, I think Davros is taken out of his time stream by the Time Lords after creating the Dalek. In the 2005 one, because it's Terry Malloy, it is after Revelation when he's going back to Skaro. So by he's being trialed for his crimes against, you know, all of creation and shown, basically shown various originally shot clips.
I was going to say they're on YouTube because I've watched.
Yes, you can view those. That's the what some of the only media that you can sort of reclaim from that. So they restaged bits from Planet of the Daleks on Spyridon in not a garden center, but you know, one of those Eden Project type places.
Yeah, yeah. They're really good. I mean,
yeah, they are.
Go overboard for anyone who hasn't seen them. For saying they are done by a charity on presumably
and
no money.
For the time, it's unfortunate
they're very much Pertwee era, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's very much the, you know, the Draconians look cool and the...
Yeah, all those costumes that they put together. You know, that's their bread and butter. That's what they do. They put together their, what they call now, cosplays and do these fundraising events. But they made some, you know, this film stuff shot on a... you know, a DV camcorder back in the day, so it's not quite as crystal clear as perhaps we get now.
Yeah.
But there's a brilliant charm to that that I think really evokes sort of what they are trying to recreate. So it's quite appropriate in its own way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think they achieve a sort of level that the Pertwee era got. So it's you know, so hats off to them for that. And they have the master. The Delgado.
Yes.
Well,
funny thing about that, he's in the behind the scenes. They recreate a half mask of Roger Delgado for the Frontier in Space.
Is it got like smoke blowing across so that.
Yes. So you'd only see him in long shots, sort of directing that battle in Frontier in Space when they
really
emerge over the clifftop.
As well.
Yeah. And I think they did shoot, I remember seeing a clip where. Basically, to pick up from the slightly rushed ending of Frontier, where he is shot and exterminated and becomes the crispy master.
That's right.
His
face
melts. But that wasn't included in the actual show. So I think they thought twice about that one, which is fair enough.
It's really grim. Like it's really gory, isn't it? Because it kind of turns into this horrible, horrible skeleton skull kind of face. Covered in crispiness.
Yeah, in the behind the scenes, though, this mask they made of Delgado was incredible. It's a shame it didn't get used in a way. But yeah, it's they totally earned it. You know, they put in the effort, they put in the attention to detail, and it absolutely landed and sang on the night because, you know, Davros wasn't part of the TV series that had gone out that year. In fact, the big finale when the Daleks then invade Gallifrey sort of indirectly tying into the Time War, they wheeled out, and this is the first time I'd seen this, a new series Dalek prop. Someone had already made one, and this was...
I was going to say the Daleks are actually in it as well, I take it.
Yeah, at the very end. I think a special weapons Dalek comes out, a couple of Genesis ones, and the new bronze Dalek. So someone had built one already, and it was there in action, and it just tied it all together.
Fundraisers, why aren't we having a remount of Davros the stage play?
It would be incredible if they did.
Yes.
I'd go and see it.
You'd
unfortunately,
be in it.
I believe the theatre's not there anymore.
No, but you'd be in it.
But ooh.
Yeah.
I'd love it if they did do an audio adaptation. Even if it was for charity again, it would be smashing.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder.
Because it's Terry Malloy hasn't been in the makeup or in the chair since.
No.
So I guess it was the last time to see that. And that was all excellently done and done specially for that performance.
Yeah, I mean, Davos is just such an amazing creation. Did you ever see the Time Fracture in London?
I didn't. I didn't, unfortunately, because
I went
twice. Had all their problems.
He's eight now, but he was like five or six, maybe seven, whenever it was we went. And really loved it. And it was so good. But that was... you know, that was live Doctor Who like this, but one of the most memorable parts of it, because you never knew which bit you were going to go into.
Yeah, it had multiple
which people
strands.
To go again. So they had the same story, but a lot of improv from the actors.
Yeah.
I think the actors must have loved doing it, or else they'd be going mad if they weren't loving it, because
it was
a lot of work, but, you know, and constantly, and we were encouraged to sort of play you know, not just be passive. And having my son there as the 25th Doctor meant that they really bounced off him. Mm. Like, what are you doing here? I'm the 25th Doctor. And so he was just running around corridors with his sonic screwdriver. Like, he was in the show. It was amazing. Mm. Just like, oh God, it was just like, God, I wish I was a kid getting to do that. Yeah. But
the people that went to it said it was, you know, it was brilliant, but yeah. I think they got a really raw deal with, you know, all the difficulties they came up against.
There was floodings and all sorts, weren't there?
But yeah, and it was basically in 2020 when was all that other stuff going on.
Yeah,
But maybe one day it'll come back.
Yeah, well, I heard rumours it might come to Manchester, but that might just be rumours. But it was a brilliant storyline as well. I mean, it was a really good storyline, and you know, I won't spoil it for anyone because they might want to dust it off and do it again. They certainly should. But yeah, but the reason I'm talking about it so much as well is because we went the first time and loved it. And then the second time, we ended up going off on a different route, walk in this room, and we could smell the dry ice as we go in. Davros is there, and I didn't even know he was in it for some reason.
Oh.
Davros was there, and my son, who was so into it, ran up to Davros, and then ran behind me. Was terrified and almost started crying because the makeup was amazing. The dry ice really, you know.
And if you're not expecting it as well.
It was a real shock because I think he thought it was a model, and then he went.
Then it moved.
And started moving and speaking. And it was absolutely, but it was, and it wasn't just my son. The grown-ups were like, oh my God. And like people were genuinely, I'd love to know who the actor was doing it, but it was absolutely brilliant. Really was like one of my favorite Davros moments, and it was live, much like yours. So it's you know, Davros, what a character. Again,
got the Daleks. Those experiences,
and then they top it by showing us his creator. I mean, you know, they top the Daleks by making it the creator of the Daleks. Yeah. Even more iconic in some ways.
Seems like such an obvious idea, but it was genius, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Here he is.
There he is.
Here he is, my little
wrinkly boy.
Yeah, well, that last little bit brings me on to something Kenny Smith told me I should mention to you, which is action figures. Because you make action figures, which is something I did not know.
Yes.
Is that right?
Doctor Who fans, I think
you
a lot of us are
geek.
Collectors
geek.
By nature.
You make action figures.
Yeah. And I believe the action figure line is one of the widest, or like there's one of the biggest in history, I think, in terms of the number of figures they've made.
Oh, really?
But that's not enough for me. I have to go one better and make my own of the characters I do want to see. And there's quite a community for it, really. And people make heads and, you know, special parts. So
is this all because of? I mean, I'm really ignorant of this, but is it all because of? You know, because of 3D printing and things like that it makes.
Yeah, mainly, and just through people sharing what they've made and think, oh, that's an interesting way of doing that. I think I could do that as well. So through that, I've developed other skills like painting eyes. Oh my God, yeah, you have to do two of them, and they have to match. But it's a really rewarding process, and one thing that I enjoy because it just lets me focus. And I like putting on my big finish in the background, and just the hours literally fly by.
Wow.
And as I was saying, you have a physical result at the end that you can keep.
Yeah. So do you actually design? Talk me through this. So you actually
talk you through this. Okay.
Do you actually design the figure?
No. There are certain individuals that. The main thing is the heads. I used to sort of harvest parts from either other figures or other lines and think, oh, if I tweak that, that could be such and such, like a Jamie or a Zoe, and put that on that body, and that'd be near enough. Mm. But over the years, it's stepped up, and people have offered up, you know, actual custom, quite high quality sculpts, really, all unofficially, I should add, not naming names. But you know they're available, and
so they
the other part,
they send you the part, they print them and send them to you. So you don't.
So if you've got the likeness, I think you're halfway there.
And you print it or something.
Yeah,
which I suppose would work as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but with the bodies and that, you have to be a bit more creative still and find parts that will translate and can be repurposed for other characters. Otherwise, you more or less have to sculpt it all yourself, and that's another skill in what you can build up and build upon. Like one I've made is Azal from the Demons.
Oh, wow.
Which is basically sculpting on all that hair.
Wow.
And his goat legs, and making it in a way that he'll actually stand up.
And his furry butt.
So. Yeah. So yeah, it's things like, it's just problem solving in the end, and facing a challenge, and how are you gonna
what do you use to sculpt? Is that
it's called Milliput, but it's like a two-part epoxy resin. So it goes plasticine, and then it hardens like almost like rock.
Yeah, Milliput was the word. Yeah, because I've been a sitting around the table role player all my life, but I don't have the artistic skills, so I've avoided becoming a war gamer. But lots of friends I know are.
And yeah, my friend calls it the plastic crack.
Yeah,
because it's so expensive and almost endless.
But Milliput is what they're always adding bits onto their space and dwarves and stuff, or making standing stones or whatever.
If it's good enough for Henry Cavill.
He's
handsome and a nerd. You can't have both. Pick one. It's really irritating.
Well, I think David Tennant, just to pick one example.
Exactly. Yeah.
Handsome.
So he's made
a
career out of it. Yeah.
I think there are a few.
He's living the dream.
But yeah, no, that sounds brilliant. But anyway, it has been great to meet you.
And you.
Over this Zoom call. I've only met you once in real life, in Derby, of all places.
Yeah, in a Premier Inn.
In a Premier Inn.
What happens at a Premier Inn stays in a Premier Inn.
Yeah, nothing happened in a Premier Inn. but other than a few beers, very civilized, and a big steak, I seem to remember. But anyway, I'm waffling on. So it is. It's been great to talk to you,
and
I look forward to seeing you in the real world.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Stevenson of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.